Hola, Sue. So this afternoon, right on schedule, we'll begin the cycle again of the four immeasurables, and we will start with loving kindness for ourselves. And as we do so, in our fourfold division quest, I would invite you to dig deep and challenge the mainstream. It's the mainstream, and it's global now. It's not just in the West, it's everywhere. It's in India, of course, it's China, dominates China. Euro-America started it to a large extent, and it's everywhere. It's Mexico, it's everywhere. And that is this just massive, almost frenzy to consume the earth. It's as if we're a virus and just wants to eat the earth alive and get all those external resources and consume as quickly as possible. And it's insatiable. So insofar as we all, you know, adopt a materialistic attitude, then all of the sources of happiness are coming from outside, which means all the focus, all the effort, all the time will be focused on how much can we acquire, how much we, can we consume, and this is held to be a good thing. The Secretary of Treasury in the United States just mentioned just recently, a couple of days ago, that the ideal is we really need to increase, consumption. The public consumer index. We need to get people to consume more. This is a good thing. This is the ideal. This is what we need to strive for always. Can we consume, we Americans, can we consume more and more? Because this is a healthy economy. That's a healthy economy. And this is not stated by a person who is simply insane. So we have this massive faith that if we can just acquire more and consume more, and get more from the environment, we'll just be happier and happier despite all the evidence to the contrary. It's an addiction. Addicted people are insane. I mean, really, limited or large. But it's a mental aberration, and it's dominating the mind of modernity, still fixated. And we've, you know, persuaded other countries around the world, even Mother India, becoming so materialistic now, following the great lead of the United States and so forth. So we have this tremendous faith, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that if we can just acquire more, consume more, just, you know, just like a vacuum sweeper, just skim off all the resources of planet Earth. And then the really good news is that only 21 light years from here, there's another planet that may support life. And I was thinking the solution is we should get all of the countries of the world to unite and put some massive rocket engines on one side of the Earth, and turn them on at the right time each year, or, you know, at each day when the Earth is circling, so that we push our Earth over towards the nearest one. So by the time we've completely sucked our Earth dry, we can all hop off and suck another one. And then send our Earth, return it and say, get the hell out, because you're just a dry husk that we suck, you know, we suck dry. And then we can kind of do that around the galaxy. We'll get a good reputation. Human beings welcome, you know? Now, I have heard that if China grows at the present rate of consumption of and so forth and so on, we're going to need, in 40 years, we'll need another Earth. We'll need another Earth to satisfy our appetite. And that's just for China. And of course, China's following the lead of the West. What are they? They're not doing anything new. They're just following our lead. So it is this massive faith that if we can consume more, we will satisfy our insatiable desire to find greater happiness. And so the Buddha said, my teachings go against the grain. Well, if that was true 2,500 years ago, boy, is it true now. And so the vision of our own happiness, as Gatrudamucha told his students, the reason you're not satisfied with your practice is because you don't have enough faith. And that is not so much a matter of faith in the guru or the Dharma, is you don't have faith in yourself, in your own internal resources. So while the thrust of modernity is to have an insatiable appetite, as if we all want to become sumo wrestlers, you know, just bulging over with fat from our massive overconsumption. Insatiable desire for happiness from the outside. When it comes to cultivating happiness from the inside, we think we're really something special if we're doing 20 minutes of meditation a day, and we'll brag about it. You know, right after my massage, I meditate. Wow, how long? 20 minutes. Whoa, you're really serious. How many hours a week do you work? 60 to 70. That pretty well tells it all, I think. That is, we're we're putting our lives where our mouths are, our mouths where our lives are, whatever. We are devoting our time to that which we value. That's the simple fact. I get here so many times, oh, I wish I had more time to meditate, but I really just don't have time. I'd love to, but I just don't have time. Of course, that's just because they value other things more. So as we, and so it's just, it's diametrically opposed. And it's not only Buddhism. It's not only the teachings of the Buddha, but it's of the great contemplative traditions around the world. They've been saying it for centuries. Thomas Aquinas, one of the brilliant people to appear in the Christian tradition, you might recall, he said, the whole point of the political life is the contemplative life. The whole point of the pursuit of mundane happiness by way of education, health, recreation, work, affluence, and all of that, what's the whole point of all of it? Just so we can make another generation of people who work themselves to death, and they can do it and set up their children and work themselves to death. All those labor-saving, you know, us geezers in our 60s and older, remember all the labor-saving devices in the 1950s, and they were making all these predictions. Boy, in 20, 30 years, people will only work 3 hours a day, or three days a week. The weekends will get longer and longer. Why? Because all the labor-saving devices, and people will just hang out and just eat marshmallows. You know, just have a good time because they have so much leisure. Well, of course, just the opposite has happened. Now you'll hardly find a couple where both don't work and are working our brains out just to keep our head above water. Sooner or later, maybe it will dawn on the general public that this materialist ideal of consumption, acquisition, consumption isn't working out too well. But we can get a head start by envisioning with intelligence and wisdom and drawing from memory and what is actually known about what actually makes people happy, to shift the faith. And Buddhism is very strong on this point, and so are the other traditions. Christianity is very clear on this point, encouraging a radical disillusionment. Someone, I won't mention the name, but one of you just used the word so poignantly a couple of days ago. Fooled. I was fooled. Fooled. Fooled by what? This whole hypnosis of thinking, get your degree, get ahead, get the good job, get the money, get the house, get the nice car, the really snazzy car. The really, really snazzy car. Now that's going to make you happy. You know, and I was fooled. Remember? I was fooled. It's like having a friend. You thought it was good friend, and the guy has been schlocking you the whole time. Just stealing. I mean, it's really kind of a betrayal if you trust someone. And then you find after years of trust, you find they've been embezzling you all the way through. Big, happy smile. I'm your friend. Robbing you blind. That could be pretty, pretty disillusioning. And that's what samsara does for us. And we make ourselves open to it because of delusion, craving, and hostility. No faith in our internal resources. All faith externally. And then, strangely enough, we suffer. So as we envision our own happiness, let's just turn it around, if you wish. I mean, this is an invitation. Just to adopt the monastic ideal, whether or not we ever become monks, of being content with that which is adequate. The whole point of hedonic pleasure is to provide us a platform, a fertile field for being able to cultivate the most meaningful life possible, to follow the contemplative life, whether we're parents, whether we're monks, whether living in a retreat, whether living in society, that one way or another, we give up attachment to this life, which suggests a radical disillusionment with the whole message of modernity. Just, I see you, and you've been lying to me my whole life, and you can continue lying, but I'm not going to believe you anymore. Sorry, but you can't fool me anymore, because I've finally seen your true face. And I'm going to place my trust in those who've been exploring another type of resource, which is absolutely not competitive. If the Dalai Lama has more, we don't have any less. Lama Zubar Rinpoche has more, nobody has any less. Glenn has more, Dazangla has no less. In fact, if Glenn has more, he'll inspire the people around him, and I'm sure has, to discover their own internal resource and find what genuine happiness is all about. So it's a radical reorientation. It's 100%, it's a revolution. To become completely disillusioned, radically. I see you, and you've been lying to me. You've been fooling me. And you go ahead and try all your best, but I will not be fooled anymore. I will tap the world lightly and take it from it what I truly need. And that is my entitlement. But then the whole focus is going to be exploring where I can actually find genuine happiness, meaning, satisfaction, fulfillment. And it's not going to be from a hunter-gatherer approach. It's going to be from a cultivating approach. It's always been true, always will be true. And we finally become sane. We get over the addiction. We find out what truly brings happiness. And to envision that, to envision the type of transformation needed, to realize that, and to realize the best that we can offer to the world in return. As I mentioned earlier, probably about 10 teaching days ago, I strongly suspect all of us here are moved to varying degrees, but meaningfully, by a spirit of altruism, wanting to do something good for the world. I doubt that there's anybody here that says, what? You're not talking to me. No, I don't think so. I think all of you, all of us here. But as we envision, what can we offer to the world? What's the best we can offer to the world? The whole message from outside, from the world around us, as soon as we step outside of the mind center into samsara central, which is everywhere else. Not quite, but you know what I mean. The message is the only way you can really do any good for the world is by being productive and by using your coarse mind, because that, of course, is all there is to you. Be productive with your body, with your speech, use your coarse mind, and that's what you got. That's what you can give. Completely oblivious of what we might offer from deeper dimensions of our own existence, from the substrate consciousness, from Rigpa, completely oblivious. So we're treated as surfaces. I mean, to say it's superficial is literally correct. This modern, this materialistic reductionist view of human existence is looking at us all as surfaces. We are only surfaces. I had a correspondence with Cliff Sarin today, very nice correspondence. But I was commenting on a recent media coverage of the Shamatha Project, that allusion to, until now all we have is anecdotal testimonials about meditation and its benefits. But now the scientists are getting involved and they're getting concrete results. What are the concrete results? Data analysis, you know, and drawing some conclusions from the data analysis. Gigabytes, terabytes of data. And I challenged Cliff, and Cliff didn't say this. It was not at all personal at all. Cliff is a multidimensional person, I'm happy to say. And we all are, but we sometimes, conceal it well. But Cliff's point was simply, what the journalist in question here was saying is that the scientists are getting measurable effects. I said, well, what do you think contemplatives have been doing for the last 25 years? We are measuring. We are detecting. We are experiencing the benefits of meditation. We're gaining insights through the practice of meditation. This is measurement. It's first person. It's replicable. This is expanding our experience, expanding our insight. You think that meditators have not been taking account of, have not been measuring, have not been detecting, have not been aware of the benefits of meditation? That you only get this by getting some machines out there and observing behavior, blood, and EEG and so forth? So this notion of human beings being all surface, the only thing that counts is what's on the surface. What is measurable with the five physical senses is absolutely an I-it relationship to human beings. Absolutely. It's all surfaces. That's what appearances are. An iPhone has only surfaces. You can look through it, you can take it entirely apart. There is no part of the iPhone that is not a surface. It is 100% surfaces. But I look over at Glenn or Joachim, and it's not just surfaces. If I'm attending only to surfaces, then I'm just missing who you are, because you're a sentient being looking back. And that's not a surface. That's interiority. And so we get this message, it's all of a piece, and this is what I'm really rebelling against, very happily, sometimes not so happily, but always with enthusiasm. And that is the notion of hollow men, hollow women, hollow human beings, that we're all surfaces, as articulated so well by perhaps the most renowned philosopher of mind in the United States, who said we are mindless robots comprised of mindless robots. We're all surfaces, we're hollow. There is no such thing as qualia, the immediate contents of experience. It's just the brain. And consciousness is simply a function of the brain, of course. And then when this same person turns his attention to contemplatives, or as in Christian contemplatives, Buddhist contemplatives who devote year on end to devoting themselves single-pointedly in solitude to meditative practice, his evaluation is, and I quote him almost verbatim, the most that can be said for them is they're not hurting anybody. In other words, they're completely useless. Unlike those nuns who are really working in hospitals and schools and so forth, those contemplatives, well, they're just a bloody waste of time. And why? Because they're robots that are just sitting there doing nothing. A robot that just sits there doing nothing is one that should be dismantled and sold for its parts. I mean, what's a robot for if it just sits there, using up good electricity? What do? I sit here. Yeah, but besides that, I follow my breath. Pull the plug. You know, you're eating good food. This is exactly what the Chinese communists said of the monks in Tibet. You're eating good food. You're parasites. Pull the plug. We'll kill you, imprison you, or you can disrobe. Your choice. But you are robots. And we're going to pull the plug. You know? And they did. So it's all of a piece. It's all of a piece. So, to embrace our interiority, to emphasize, shine a bright light on our inner resources, to break loose of the shackles of the hollow men syndrome that's dominating the modern mind, and to envision what it would be like to truly flourish from the inside out, from our way of life, from the balance of the mind, to knowing reality as it is. Let's break free, because the current's flowing in the opposite direction. Okay? The meditation will have few words. I think you know the routine, so let's jump in. Let your first breath in the meditation be itself an act of loving kindness for yourself. Your very entry. To soothingly release your awareness into the space of the body, right down to the ground. Settling your body in its natural state, your respiration in its natural rhythm. Calming, soothing, setting at ease this troubled mind with mindfulness of breathing. then arouse the luminous creativity of your own mind, your imagination, your vision. And envision, as if for the first time, what would make you truly happy. Happy not only in the sense of some feeling arising that you might be able to get from a drug or electrical stimulation of the appropriate part of the brain. We're not dealing with trivia here. What would make you truly happy? A sense of fulfillment, of meaning. Envision your own flourishing. And imagine, if you will, that your imagination does not extend beyond your potential. And imagine your potential symbolically as an orb of light at your heart, and with each out-breath, arouse the yearning. May I be truly well and happy. And with each out-breath, fill your whole being with this light from your heart. Letting your imagination play. Imagine realizing here and now the fulfillment of your heart's desire. turn your awareness outwards to the world around you, with the awareness that it will be possible to realize your own potential, your own dream, your own vision, only with the help of those around you. None of us can do this in isolation. So if you will envision, first of all, what would you love to receive? In this spirit of loving kindness for yourself, what would you love to receive from the world around you? From friends and teachers, those who are close and those who are far. With each in-breath, arouse the yearning, may I receive all that I truly need to be well, to be happy. And imagine the goods and the blessing of the world flowing in upon you with each in-breath. the awareness that there's no way to realize such well-being without inner transformation of the most radical sort. Envision now how you'd love to transform, to mature, to evolve as a human being, a sentient being, in order to realize your heart's desire. And with each out-breath, breathe life into that vision as you fill your whole body and mind with the light from your heart. And imagine becoming the kind of person you'd love to become. Free of all that encumbers, obstructs, and obscures your inner resources. And richly endowed with all those qualities that will help you realize your fullest potential. And finally, a life that is led entirely for oneself is one almost entirely devoid of meaning. To imbue our own lives with as much meaning as possible, according to our own lights, our own imagination, our own wisdom. Imagine now, what would you love to offer to the world? Drawing from all dimensions of your being to be of greatest possible benefit to those near and far in the short term and the long term. And with each out-breath arouse a yearning, may we all be truly well and happy. May we find the causes of genuine happiness. Breathe out your light into the world. release all appearances and objects and effortlessly let your awareness descend and come to rest in its own place, illuminating its own nature, in stillness, in simple being. Nassau. Let's see what the Daily Mail says. The question is, would I tell you about the contemplative observatory, the missing link between the ramp and the freeway? Sure. A place in a land where visas, long-term renewable visas, can be gotten without much expense, where cost of building maintenance is not too high, where food is relatively inexpensive, where people can live for no rent, and with no concerns about mundane issues, just be able to focus single-pointedly on the practice of Dharma. Or, so that's it. We're looking. We'll see. Here's a very practical question. Over the last couple of days, I'm encountering some eye strain. I think it developed while doing settling the mind practice, but it has carried over into other practices as well. I try to relax my face and eyes, but haven't been able to remedy the problem. Advice. Very, very good practical question. Yeah, it can happen with settling the mind. It's not uncommon, because after all, the eyes are open, and we are doing some of the eyes, that is, we're resting the gaze in the space in front of us. And so the eyes are involved, and then we're doing something special with the mind. And so it's very easy for kind of some subtle messages, so to speak, to come creeping into the vision. And we want just the opposite. So to give the closest analogy, imagine that it's a, you know, you're working, you're doing a 9-to-5 job, 5-6 days a week, and then come along Sunday, and it's just a free time. So imagine a nice warm Sunday afternoon going out onto a kind of a hillside and lying on your back and just saying, what a day for a daydream. You know, just relaxing, eyes open, and just having a nice, a little half an hour of Tahiti, and then maybe, some nice castles in Bavaria, and then off to Japan, see some geisha girls, and, you know, just letting your mind rove. And of course, your eyes are open. You don't need to close your eyes to daydream. With that quality of just total relaxation, and you're not even giving any attention to the eyes at all. The eyes are just maybe staring up into the sky. And of course, you blink whenever you feel like, but there's just absolutely nothing funny going on with the eyes, because your mind is simply elsewhere. So that's the idea. And it is a balance there. David raised the issue earlier of, you know, trying to focus on the space of the mind, and yet the eyes are kind of like the visual field is shouting at you. Hey, look at me, you know? And there it is. It is subtle. So when problems like this are arising, almost certainly there's something a little bit fishy going on with the vision. Whether not blinking or a bit of eye strain, a bit too much effort coming to the visual gaze and so forth. So what I would suggest always, whenever I see something like this, and I've told everybody this, if you start feeling pressure in the head, headaches, immediately back off. That's just not a road to go down, right? Back off, come down to the abdomen. Go full body awareness is fine. Go for a walk, and I'll tell this to everybody. I've told you many individually. Going for a walk, let your awareness come out into space. Let your gaze look out at the clouds, the hilltops, and so forth. Bring your awareness spacious, spacious, spacious. So any kind of pent-up energy around the eyes, the forehead, the head, and so forth, all gets diffused, right? So I would not let that become a habit at all. Immediately take counter steps, probably shift the practice, and also just don't tell David, between you and me, as they say on television, just between you and me. If you want to close your eyes once in a while and settle in the mind, go ahead and do it. But David can't. You know, just to, you know, just to see if that can help. Because settling the mind is a very profound practice. It can be very rich with insight, extremely useful for daily life and so forth. So it'd be good if all of us could have some familiarity with it when the retreat's over. Say, well, I may not be great at it, but yeah, I didn't fail. I know how to do it. I had some really good sessions. You know, if you just have that, I had some really good sessions. I know what it's like to do it correctly. And it was without eye strain, without pressure in the head, without any of the crummy stuff. To have that, just to having, you know, even if it winds up being just, you know, 5% of your practice, because the main thrust of the practice is going elsewhere, it would be good to know that you can do it well with no side effects. This means we can be a little bit sneaky, you know? And if we need to close our eyes on occasion, just to try that out, to see if you close your eyes and then do the same practice, everything else the same, does that alleviate the problem? If so, then you know you can do the practice without problems. And then from that point, then you can say, okay, I could do it with my eyes closed. Okay, I want to be sneaky because I like being sneaky. It's so much fun. And that is, okay, next I'm going to try it at 8 o'clock at night when it's dark. And I'm going to turn off all the lights in my room, maybe even pull down the blinds. And I'm going to practice with my eyes open, but maybe I can trick them to thinking my eyes are closed. You know, and try it that way. Okay? So just be sneaky. That's my pith advice. Be sneaky. Okay? Practice question. In some sessions, I start with the intuition to practice awareness of awareness, but because of noise, I decide to change and do settling the mind in its natural state. But when the noise is over, I want to change to awareness of awareness. Should I stop the session and start a new one? Or just change gears in the process, up and down? Yeah, very, very practical question. And this, of course, is very, very relevant when we're no longer living in an environment that overall is pretty quiet. I mean, I know there's construction noise, and I know it's different on different sides of the building. They gave me the quietest side, so I'm fortunate that way, but, you know, that too will pass. But if it's an issue here that sometimes there's a bit of distracting noise and other times not, well, when you return to Mexico City or to most of us where we're going from here, that's going to be the case. Sometimes quiet, sometimes not so quiet. In which case, very practical question. And my advice would be definitely within the session. We don't want to be so, fickle, so uneven, so flaky, that we're always just going, oh, I'm going to try this. Oh, that didn't work out. I'm going to try this. Oh, it didn't work out too well. I'm going to try that. Oh, all the way through and never settle down. Of course, that's one extreme. The other extreme is, no, I started this way. I have to keep it this way because somebody said, not quite sure who, but I don't want to be struck by a bolt of lightning. So I will continue the whole session, you know. So that's the other extreme. And so if in midstream, if you find that, you know, a disturbance comes up, like, you know, my classic one was that little Yorkshire Terrier that yap, yap, yap. The settling the mind was much more effective, right? So sure, feel free to move back and forth. You just won't want to do it all that often. But when there's good reason, yeah, do it. Okay? Hola, so that's all for the written questions. Any other questions pertaining to practice, first of all? Yes, we'll start with Brett.
Thank you. I'm trying to correctly categorize my problems so I can apply antidotes more effectively.
Good.
I notice myself having a craving for like a movie or an entertaining book or, you know, something where I'm, you know, merging with the thought. Does that count? And, you know, just going like losing awareness, except and just totally merging into a movie, for instance.
I missed that. The last sentence.
Losing awareness of awareness and just dropping into merging with a movie, for instance, right? Just fusing with it.
That's called OCDD.
That's OCDD. Great. Yeah. And does that count as a craving for sensual pleasure?
Yes.
Of the mind, basically? Is that the...
Oh, sensual pleasure of the desire realm, yeah.
Thank
and that's
you.
An obstruction.
Perfect.
Yeah. Charlie, good. That was easy. Sure. But by the way, with the collusion of John Broberg, we are arranging the movie. We are arranging a movie, but it won't be until the last 2 days of the retreat. And hopefully it will be a movie or DVD of Cliff Saran giving his report on the Shamatha project in the south of France. We can't guarantee it, but John is doing his best. So that should be entertaining. He's a very lively, very enjoyable speaker. Okay? But we have to wait. Yes, Pa Sang Lai, good to hear from you. Please.
This is regarding the earlier question, the changing of the object of meditation.
Right.
But I thought that when we're actually going towards shamatha, then we have to actually keep to only one object of meditation rather than changing. What is the view on that?
Over the course of time, as one progresses along the nine stages, overall, it's just likely to just observing what has happened. Not what should happen because some big authority said so, but what does happen is, especially with an 8-week boot camp of really learning how to do all of these really 20 different methods, have you considered? We have a tenfold sequence of shamatha and a tenfold sequence of the four immeasurables. That's 20 different meditations. That's a pretty rich arsenal, to learn how to use. That with that as a launching pad, then as one... so that one can venture out, either bringing these practices out into the world of socially active way of life, or whether it's continuing in full-time, single-pointed meditative practice. Either way, as one goes deeper into the practice, becomes more and more familiar with them, and really starts proceeding along the path of shamatha, which will frankly be overall easier to do if one is just doing shamatha 8-10 hours a day, rather than that mixed with a whole lot of other activities. Now, which is more meaningful in the short term, that's for each individual to determine. So there's no, I do not say, well, if you're really serious, then you'll just drop everything and go into shamatha, because that is absolutely not the best for a number of people. But if that is the route one is following, then what one does find over a matter of weeks and months is that it's almost like setting out on a cruise in a sailing vessel. And after you've been out at sea, maybe you're going around the world, after a while you slip into routine. And it will change somewhat when you come up with a squall or... dead still, dead calm, and so forth. It doesn't mean you can be rigid in the same format every single day, but barring special weather, the tempest or the doldrums, you're going to slip into a routine and say, yeah, this is how I'm sailing this vessel. This is how the crew works together. And you slip into routine, and everybody knows what they need to do, and it starts to work really smoothly. That's how the practice goes. So having said that, using the metaphor, you'll very likely find as you're in whole phases of the practice, up to stage 4, from 4 to 7 and so forth, that you're going to find one practice at any given phase that you really gravitate to. This is the one that's carrying me forward, right? And on occasion, you might temper it with another one, and it may shift in terms of these three practices. It may shift if one is doing mindfulness of breathing in the earlier phases. You just may find that you're just gravitating to, without any encouragement from outside, to settling the mind. And as you go deeper and deeper and deeper into that, it's gravitating to awareness of awareness, and that can happen. But on the other hand, you may just find mindfulness of breathing is just the vessel you want to sail in all the way there. But overall, you will settle down. Yeah. This follows both Tsongkhapa and Padmasambhava, that you may be fishing around a bit and going through different phases, but sooner or later you're going to settle down. And but having said that, just one addendum. And that is, for example, let's imagine that it's awareness of awareness, just taking it as an example. In awareness of awareness, it can be that even if one is doing it 8 hours a day, that sometimes just more like, sometimes you may just find some supine would go really well, just supine, maybe just coming to the ground. I've been flying at 35,000 feet for eight hours. Maybe I'm going to come down and just be present on the ground for a while. An analogy of this, as a final point, would be in the Pali Canon. and the narrations of the Buddha's own life, it states, and it's quite remarkable because it really brings that humanness of the Buddha, that on occasion he would, after teaching or traveling here and there and so forth, various things happening, on occasion he would simply withdraw into the jungle or into his kutti, into his meditation hut, and he would just rest in the jhanas, like in the fourth jhana, you know, just like, even for a Buddha, time out. This is just so soothing, such a pleasing abode, that even the Buddha in the Pali Canon would say, well, hang out there. So I mean, although that's a distant analogy, something like that. So even if one is very progressed in the practice, it's all going very well, you might find the infirmary is sometimes really pleasant, or if you're doing awareness of awareness, you might just want to peek in and say, oh, by the way, what's happening in this person's mind? Oh, that. That's enough, thanks. I want to go right back to awareness of awareness. Good. Okay? Sounds like good.
Alan, yes. Since I have control of the microphone, so I have to ask one more question. What is your view regarding some of these subliminal tapes or CDs which are supposed to help?
Subliminal? AIDS?
Yeah, tapes or CDs.
Oh, tapes. Yeah. Tapes or CDs.
Where it's supposed to help to go into meditation state.
Yeah.
What is your view on that? Thank you.
Yeah, they can be very lucrative. There are all kinds of gimmicks out there. I know another one. I don't. Again, I'm really making now a consistent effort not to criticize any person, because I don't really think that's helpful. People change. By the time I've criticized the person, maybe the person's behavior has completely changed, view has changed, and there I am criticizing a corpse while they've moved on and been reborn, you know. So I want to avoid criticizing people, but keep it generic. Yeah, there's a lot of technology out there. That's some of the more primitive technology. There's some a little bit more sophisticated. And there are medications out there. There's a medication out there that's supposed to improve your memory. Can I have a bottle? I want a whole bottle. You know. So here we are. This is it. It's all the good stuff comes from outside. All the good stuff. That's the message of modernity. If you want good attention skills, good. Here, take this pill. Take this. Listen to this tape. This will do it. Put on this little set of headphones, and you know, beam me up, Scotty. You know. And so, having said that, yeah, I think these are really limited. At the same time, such merchandise, because that's what it is, when all is said and done, it's merchandise, is overall, I think without exception, frankly, aimed at developing an extremely crude level of attention skill. Extremely crude. I mean, not even probably stage two. You know. But if you have ADHD, and I say that with no sarcasm, I mean, people have ADHD. Some people have, you know, we all have limitations and problems. But if one has ADHD, then that such technology may be very helpful. And to say it's crude, we'll say, well, look, I have ADHD. You want to ridicule me? My answer is no, I don't want to ridicule anybody. Yeah? So overall, such technology at best may be helpful for overcoming attentional problems and getting back to the level of attention of those who designed those programs. And maybe we can aim a bit higher. Right? Now, having said that, a friend of mine, very good neuroscientist, has been working with a whole team, and they feel that they've got now identified, in terms of EEG, certain patterns of EEG, the electromagnetic fields generated by the brain, that are associated with the adult development of attention skills. Okay? He's a good friend of mine. I respect him. He's a very good neuroscientist. And so I've opened up a dialogue with him. We'll have a conversation probably next Sunday, because I have some ideas around this, constructive hope. I mean, they're certainly not destructive or simply critical. They're entirely constructive. To see whether such really cutting-edge technology, it seems like they're very excited about it. They think this is really very cool. Whether that might be helpful for teenagers, for children, you know, because what we're giving them from the world is a massive onslaught of sensory overload, multitasking, just complete bombardment of the senses, as if the whole world is in conspiracy to give all children ADHD, you know. And then when they get it, then we hit them with a drug, you know, gotcha. So maybe if the world is so crazy in terms of what they're getting from the classroom, the media, their toys, their video games, and so forth, if we can balance that with a little bit of technology that helps undo the damage we're inflicting upon them, that would be a good thing. But for anything more subtle, I think even thinking about achieving stage 2 or 3, I think all such technology, at least all the technology that exists thus far, should be really considered at best as trainer wheels, just helping us just get through the initial surf, the initial turbulence of the mind. Now, who knows? I mean, I'm very skeptical. At the same time, I don't want to be close-minded. Maybe some incredible technology will be developed. Maybe it has been, and I don't know anything about it, that can be used for developing much, much higher levels of attentional balance. Maybe there'll be some drug or some direct electrical stimulation that will just burn off all the bad neurons, or what have you. So I'm very skeptical of that. But again, I keep on reading. I'm waiting to see if they can come up with something that is not primitive. So far, pretty primitive. But there's a deeper issue here. And so maybe they will develop good technology. Maybe there'll be some incredible breakthrough that gets people to stage 4 or stage 5, whatever. But this is where this raises a much deeper issue, one I'm passionately concerned about, and that is our cultivation. You all know now the sequence. We've done it twice already, the whole sequence of 10 days with meditations in the morning and the afternoon. And you know the whole ambience here, that we know all of our practice here is rooted in ethics, and I haven't seen any faltering of that in terms of my awareness of everybody's behavior here. It's laudable. I think the staff love us, that we've been gracious, we've been hospitable, we've been ethical, they've been fantastic to us. So we're practicing ethics here with respect to the staff, the surrounding community, among ourselves. This is the way it should be. This is wonderful, right? But that's the root that we're all treating. I think we really are. I don't know of any exceptions. I think we're all treating each other very decently, at the very least. And often there are these wonderful effulgences of really quite extraordinary kindness, which always brings such happiness, you know? So that's our ground. That's what we consider normal here in our mind center, right? Well, some of them may be in for a rude awakening when the retreat's over to rediscover that that's not normal everywhere, you know? And so whatever attentional balance we're cultivating here is utterly rooted, very much like a plant having roots in rich, nutritious soil, fertile soil, that whatever attentional balance we're cultivating here is rooted in a very ethical way of life with, I think, noble aspirations. That's what the afternoons are all about, a kind heart, open heart, and all of that. So all of this is the mulch, the fertilizer, the warmth, the moisture to cultivate attentional balance. It's coming with motivation, the 4 immeasurables, its ethics, all of that of a piece. And in the midst of this, so many of you, many, many of you, are finding also real insights of self-knowledge, finding things coming up psychologically, emotions, desires, grappling with deep issues and so forth. So clearly, we're not here to learn some gimmicks, some little tricks. You know, how can you develop attentional vividness? Oh yeah, there's a trick here, you know. We're not. I mean, this is really embedded. We're all swimming in deep waters now. And I think that's the way it should be. That's the way the Buddha taught it. That's the way the great Christian contemplatives taught it, and the Hindu contemplatives taught it, and the Taoist contemplatives taught it. They all taught it within a deep, fertile bed of ethics and a rounded, larger context of spiritual practice, meaningful transformation, and connectedness with the world. Right? So that's really rich. And it's really good. Right? Now, if we say, Alan, that's very sweet what you had to say, but you know, I'm working 70 hours a day, and I need results fast, and that's really sweet about that, but I don't have time to come to Thailand. I don't have 8 weeks. I'm way too busy for that. I need something just fast. I need something fast. So give me the shortcut. Well, maybe they'll come up with technology that will give them that shortcut. But do we really want to have people with a very degraded level of ethics, no special cultivation of kindness, 3 mental afflictions, the root mental afflictions, alive and well, delusion, craving, hostility, just flourishing. But by the way, with that same level of craving, hostility, and delusion, now you get to be really single-pointed. So this is why I love teaching what I teach. Because it's so sane, it's so good, all the way right down to the roots. And when I see people looking for shortcuts, I say, yeah, I know why you're looking for shortcuts, because your priorities are elsewhere. That's why you're not looking for a shortcut for other things, but you're looking a shortcut for genuine happiness. But hedonic, oh, you're willing to put 67 hours a week to a hedonic. That's where your values are. So that's not what your values are. That's why you're wearing robes. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I think he will get the microphone if you really ask him nicely. Or we can have an early break. Wouldn't that be wondrous? Amazing. Yeah, Jacob. Off we go.
Just a small point about the supine position. Sometimes if I'm like this, it can start feeling quite constraining somehow.
Constraining to be like this for the people listening on podcasts, flattering your back on top to the side, right? He did not turn upside down and stand
on
his head.
Right. But it feels good sometimes.
Oh, I see what you mean. Arms up.
Yeah.
Arms up.
I'm just wondering if there's any reason not to do that.
I think this is the full sign of I surrender. Right? This is I surrender, but this is I really surrender. Sure, it opens things up. It opens the chest up. It opens the shoulders up. So just don't tell Iyengar that I said so, because he taught Shavasana, arms 30 degrees out from the side, palms up, and that's really good. But sometimes having the arms up does open up the chest. It opens up the diaphragm. And so, yeah, why not? Because, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, they don't say in a future time, in the 20th century, there will come a man named BKS Iyengar, and you must follow him like God. You know, there's no such prophecy that I know of. He's an outstanding yoga teacher. But what the Dzogchen literature says, which I find so fascinating, and thinking of a direct quote from the Vajra Essence, is release your body as if it were a corpse in the charnel ground. Well, if you look far enough, I think you'd find some corpses with their arms up. As long as they're totally relaxed, and corpses tend to be good at that. So sure, I think you can do that. And to continue it, let you utterly release your body into its natural state, like a corpse in a charnel ground, utterly release your speech into its natural state, like a lute on which the strings have been cut, and utterly release your mind. Oh, I can't remember the analogy, but I think we all know the message. Utterly release. What's that?
Like the presence of space or something like that.
I can't hear you.
Like the presence of space or something like that.
Something like that. I think you're right. Yeah, I've quoted it many times. I think it's there in my one-week shamatha retreat lecture notes. But yeah, just releasing into space. Yeah. So yeah, the short answer, sure, if you want to say your money or your life. Both. Good. Yes, Sharon.
A few days ago, Patricia talked about the pain at her chest.
Yes.
And I've had that before also when I visualized the orb as being about the size of a pea.
Yeah.
But if I make it be about a tennis ball, then I don't have that. It's kind of like a heartburn.
Heartburn if you do the pee. But if it's a tennis ball, it's no heartburn.
It's no heartburn, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And also, it seems to be too much sometimes when you're saying bring in the darkness, mm-hmm. and then bring in the darkness, bring in the darkness, bring in the darkness. Mm-hmm. So if I'm feeling the sensation, I just do it once.
That's fine. And then, yeah. The last thing we want to do in that practice, and this is actually a cautionary note about the practice of Donglen, is that it should not feel oppressive. It should not feel oppressive at any time. It really shouldn't. And that's why, you know, these are deep waters, to imagine taking in not only the suffering but the evil of the world. Well, there's some pretty heavy-duty evil out there, right? And so to imagine drawing that in, well, this is not a trivial thing. Even though it's purely in the realm of imagination, nevertheless, imagination can be pretty powerful. And so insofar as drawing it in, the whole emphasis is drawing it in, and even without breathing before you say it, draw it in and extinguish it without trace. You know, draw it in. And what this is, the implicit message is really, really clear, and that is this light at your heart is just can devour and consume the darkness of the whole universe, and not even dim by one watt. So it's a profound affirmation of the fathomless light of purity, primordial purity, of your own pristine awareness. I mean, it's the one taste of the whole of samsara nirvana, so it's a pretty big deal. Yeah? In terms of the size of this orb of light that you visualize at the heart, whether it's the size of a pea, of a BB, of an electron, or of a tennis. I like tennis. So I'd go for tennis myself. So definitely, sure. That's no problem. Just not green. Just green tennis balls. They're a little bit weird. So make sure it's nice radiant white. Good. Yes, off to Jessica.
Okay, so you've talked about how tapping into the substrate can allow for a lot of creativity to emerge.
Yep, that's true.
And so on this retreat, I'm not engaging in too many creative endeavors because that would be distracting from the practice.
Quite so, yeah.
But if you're engaging in the practice over a long period of time, mm-hmm. and you also want to write music or paint or do whatever creative thing you do, mm-hmm. Do you have advice for balancing that?
Sure. Yeah, now is a really good time to, since we're in this very exceptional environment, I think we all pretty well know how unusual this type of environment is, you know, that's been so carefully crafted by Klaus and the wonderful talent that he's brought in. Here, I really had nothing to do with it. I just applaud, you know. Thank you, Klaus. But he, you know, has such extremely good taste, and then he hires people with extremely good taste, all the way across. I mean, it's homogenous. So we're in an unusual environment now, and so which is specifically, as we all know, designed to really help us go inward and explore the mind center. I mean, I must say, I really like the name of this place. And so not kind of launching out into the effulgences, the expressions, the displays of the creativity of our own subject consciousness, but try to simply settle more and more deeply into it so that we get the taste of it and we know where we can come back to in the future, even after we've left this place and perhaps gone into a more complex, socially engaged environment, way of life, that we've tasted it. We know from our own experience, this is a big deal, that we know from our own experience what we did, that it wasn't just divine grace, and when I say that, it's not pejoratively, but just happened for no reason that we can figure out. No, I was practicing, and then this opened up. And so there was some causality there, and to know that. So for the time being, I think you're right on the right track to simply focus on the practice. Just go as deep as we can, and let your creativity flow out into the four measurables, because there's plenty of room for creativity there, right? But now to answer your question, when we venture back, sure, oscillating in and out from just really withdrawing your awareness into itself, and any of these methods will work. In my experience, the two that are really, how do you say, most conducive or prone to arousing, to unleashing the creativity of the substrate are mindfulness of breathing and settling the mind. the awareness of awareness tends to just go right into it, into its stillness, which means you're going into, again, the parallel here is really strong, of the two stages of Dzogchen, the Tekchu, which is penetrating right through to pristine awareness beyond all activity, beyond coming and going, beyond this and that, beyond all conceptual frameworks and constructs, to primordial stillness beyond time. And as I, and that's just straight Dzogchen talk. And what I was suggesting is that is exactly the dimension of consciousness that an arhat accesses only after he or she dies. That's deep, right? That's the inactive aspect of it. But then on the other hand, there are the effulgences, the displays, manifesting out into the vast expanse of the Buddha's wisdom, knowledge, awareness of the panoramic display of phenomena, the display of compassion, the display of powers of the Buddha mind, the Sambhogakaya, the Nimanakaya, all these are the effulgences, the displays, right? Activity. Hlungidupa, the spontaneous activation. Well, that you get from the Tutgel, the direct crossing over, the culminating phase of Dzogchen practice. But having just read just recently, I'm translating one of his many treatises by Dujun Lingba, he makes it very clear that first, in this sequence between Tekchu and Tutgel, first, you establish your ground. You master the ground of ascertaining, knowing non-dually, pristine awareness. You establish your base camp. And from that base camp, then you venture into the practices to draw forth all of the creative potential of that ultimate ground of awareness. So it's really a little bit, I mean, it's not a bad analogy, I think, to be drilling, let's say, out in the desert for water, and drilling, and finally hitting the groundwater. And so you know it, a little cupful comes up, you know, but you know that the tip is wet. That's what's really important, the drill bit, this down 800 feet, 1,500 feet, you know, has finally gone far enough down that you've tapped into the groundwater, right? And you know it's wet. Whether any water came to the surface or not, you know it's wet down there. You hit it, right? Once you've done that, then what do? Pull the drill bit out and start pumping, right? And so there's a deep analogy for what we're referring to here. Now's the time for deep dwelling. Now's the time for, well, Klaus has done a lot of this exploratory work, looking for natural resources, you know? It's not a bad thing to do. I mean, here we are enjoying the air conditioning and electricity, so I'm hardly down on touching lightly the natural resources of our planet. And Klaus has been involved in that, and he's told me that that's how you do it. You make many explorations, and then eventually, if you're fortunate, you tap into that which you're looking for. And so I would suggest this time here, these 8 weeks here, are really exploratory ventures to tap into the deep groundwater of our own awareness. And for this, in this limited context, we should be satisfied with the substrate, even though that's not the ultimate groundwater. And then when you come out into the world, then, I think I've really been beating around the bush a lot, I'll finally answer your question. Then as we're going in and out, that is spending time in meditation, actively engaging with the world, in and out, at times you may want to practice simply because you want to practice. You'd like to simply go back into shamatha practice and go right back into stillness again. Perhaps when you go into meditation you want to cultivate the four immeasurables. Not for the sake of something else, but for the sake of cultivating the four immeasurables. Or it's Vajrasattva practice, or Chenrezi practice, or the four thoughts that turn the mind, and so forth. So there may be many occasions where when you go into your meditation chamber, and it's to meditate, what it's really about is simply to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And that's it, it's that simple. But it's perfectly meaningful, worthwhile, to be engaging with something very meaningful in the world, that is meaningful to you, and come up with something where you really would love to have a bit more creativity, a bit more of a plasma-like mind that's fluid and can really cast a fresh light on whatever it is you're dealing with. In which case, very simple technique. I've done it many, many times and found it very useful. And I do it pretty much every day, here, twice a day. In early morning and the last session after I've finished with the meetings going from 2 to 3. It's every day, 6 days a week. Is that I know before I go into meditation what the topic will be. because we're doing this very systematically now. So I know what it is, and that's it. And then I just go into meditation. But this is a meditation specifically knowing that at the end of the meditation, I'm going to be here and try to offer something meaningful. But it's inactive. It's inactive. I'm not sitting there using my calculating mind, blah, 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 and what I learned at Stanford, what I learned at Amherst, what did Geshe Rabin teach me here, what did Gyatso Rinpoche, blah, 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 blah. I'm not doing that. I'm just doing the practice. But knowing in the background, implicitly, I'd like to offer my best when I come here, right? And that's all I need, just knowing this is the prelude for coming here and trying to share something meaningful. And with that being sufficient, then things bubble up. They just bubble up. And that's it. So this is for Dharma teaching, but it's absolutely not confined to that. As I know when I was, and I've told this story many times, so I'll take extremely abbreviated version, but a very, very difficult problem in advanced mechanics, Newtonian mechanics. And it was really difficult. And I'm not very gifted in that area at all. Just had to work really hard. But there was one occasion where I said, I don't see how to get into it. I went off and meditated. Mindfulness of breathing. The door opened. I said, and I went and solved the problem. And that was meaningful for me at that time. The problem in and of itself, in isolation, was not meaningful at all. But it was meaningful because I wanted to understand classical mechanics so I could get the real punch of what quantum mechanics was really about. That it was a revolution going beyond the assumptions and so forth of classical mechanics. And I wanted to do this authentically and not just do a New Age trip on quantum mechanics. So for me, at that time, it was very meaningful. So likewise for you, whatever you're going back to, that's what I would suggest. Hold it in mind, release it, go into the meditation, and see what bubbles up. Okay? Yeah. And then you're very happy when it comes up. You don't think, uh-oh, out with you. Out with you, OCD, OCDD. You know? You say, welcome. I thought you might drop in. And you note it. And often just noting it is sufficient. And then you can just go back to the practice. I have done a bit more, and that is when I was two-thirds of the way through my doctoral studies at Stanford, I just needed to get out, you know, really just get out. And so I did. I went off for 6 months, really intense, very, very solitary retreat in the high desert in Eastern California. And I got out with the permission and the blessing of my mentor, so I didn't, you know, just bolt. But I was ABD. I was all but dissertation. And I was pretty sure I wanted to finish. And I'd already basically had a framework of one of the two dissertations I wanted to write. And I went off to retreat not to write a dissertation. I really wanted to put that behind me and just meditate for 6 months in the high desert right through the winter, so it was very, very quiet. But my mind had other ideas. So I did meditate, but whether I liked it or not, during those 6 months, a lot of ideas flowed up. And sometimes a lot would flow up in one session that were really relevant, and I thought were value of meaning for a book that was called The Taboo of Subjectivity. A lot of that came out of this six-month retreat. And sometimes when things bubbled up, they were almost kind of like nagging, like a nagging husband, nagging wife, like, I'm not going to let you go until you pay attention to me. I'm not going to let you go. I'm going to, you know, almost like that Yorkshire Terrier. You know? And so when it would be like that, then I would say, okay, you're not going to let me go, and you do have something meaningful to say. That was the problem. It was actually meaningful, you know. In which case, when it got to be that way, then I'd have just a folded up piece of paper next to where I was meditating, and I would just write down just enough, absolute minimal shorthand, so that I would know, I would remember the point when the session was over, but I give it only as many syllables as needed. I jot it down, enough, okay, and go back to the practice. And then I really could release it, and then just practice. And then when the session was over, I say, yeah, those really good, really good ideas. This will go into this chapter, that will go into that chapter, and thank you, substrate, I guess. So on occasion, if you're going to get a little bit overwhelmed by creativity, then you might want to just say, okay, I give. And just jot down, so you don't have to hold 2, 3, 4 ideas through the session, which is then just saturating the whole session with grasping and multitasking, just to get it out of the system, write it down, come back to the practice. Okay? But I found this to be the case many times. So good luck with that one. Good. Hola, so that's enough for this afternoon. So enjoy your evening, and I'll see you tomorrow morning.